This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Marcus Jackson has traveled from Ohio to be with us to share his new book, and he's going to begin with a poem.
This poem's titled When in Love. You're a drooling fool. You've got a mouth full of diamonds, and you're smiling. Your body is a key tied to a kite bitten by lightning. Troubling memories have dug escapes from the cell blocks of your brain. You're a piece of luminous fruit yet to be bruised. You gasp the way waves at night crash, and you moan like a full moon. You're something extremely expensive, carried by a clumsy kid. Spring, its worm-gorged birds and redbud trees, can't even keep up with your jubilee.
Marcus Jackson, is that the way it was? Pretty much? Or is that fantasy?
A little bit of both.
And your wife is a psychologist. What does she say about such a man that was in love with her?
She's just hoping that I don't self-destruct.
She's good. Okay, he's come from Ohio. This is a new book. What is the book about?
The book, Part of My Heart, is about the different sound-based and texture-based and emotional intersections of love in the 20th and 21st century African-American ethos.
It is about love.
Yeah.
That's what this book is all about. Yeah. Did you arrange it chronologically from boyhood to manhood, or did you collect it that way? Or were you writing a book and sequentially you went through your memory?
I wrote the poems originally chasing iambic pentameter, Shakespearean sonnets, and blank verse, and I wasn't concerned with, say, the narrative arc of the assembly of it.
Oh,
and then
right.
After a good deal of the poems were written, I assembled them so that there would be mini narratives within the sections and that there would be some type of arc across the whole book.
The craft is awesome. And I told the world that you're going to bring adjectives back and give them a good name. You are a beautiful poet.
Thank you.
And I'll tell them who you are. Undergraduate from the University of Toledo. Seems like you're an Ohio person.
Yeah.
From
birth? I was in New York for 7 or 8 years.
Well,
but I was born
in
Toledo and was there till I was about 22.
And back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, NYU graduate and Cave Canem Fellow, which is very important to our society. Published in the American Poetry Review, The New Yorker. Who was the editor?
I believe Paul was the editor for the poems that I had there.
More than one?
Yeah.
That's something. Tin House, many things. And you did have another book, Neighborhood Register, which was 2011. Pardon My Heart is out by Northwestern University. And what do people say about it?
I hope they don't say much. I hope they just feel it.
But that, I gushed. I mean, do they really say good things?
I've gotten positive feedback about it. My approach in this book, which was a little different than my first book, my first book's very narrative and travelogue driven. This book is more about creating a meld of the poetic traditions within love subjects and meshing those with blues and rock and roll and hip-hop.
And you say the African-American ethos. So what does that mean?
I think that class and socioeconomic standing and being of color renders different physicalities and cerebral, I guess, touchstones for love. Love is displayed different ways in different communities. It's got different complexities in different communities. And
I agree. And do you believe, as I do, that if people read this book, if people read books like this, it would take away so much bias, more than op-ed pieces could do? Do you believe that is because of the particulars, the details, the porthole we see through?
Yeah.
This could change the world. Poetry, I believe, has that power.
It does. It does. And it's so much closer to cinema and song poetry is for me. And I don't necessarily want to be able to have the ability to fully describe my experience as a reader of poems. And I try to make poems that do that.
Well, let's hear two of them.
Sure.
And then we'll get to know you.
This is called To the Love Gods. Thanks for those first dearest who left us for flashier suitors. Thanks for guiding us away from sleeping with the misleading people who seemed fine at the time. The woman who ended up the queen in a monarchy of rescued cats. The man who killed a clerk during a robbery. Thanks again for the condoms that didn't break. For Mrs. Moore using a cucumber in health class to so clearly demonstrate how to put a Trojan on. Thanks for the morning after pill, for abortion, for the absolution in both escape and regret. Thanks for all the solitude, all the nights our rooms were the monologues of stones. Thanks for all the quarrels, the furious mouths and unbelievable words. Thanks for your permission to mend, for prescribing time and somber songs as balms. And thanks, of course, for our hearts, those redundant drums, ushering us through the darkness that lives between the burning kingdoms of our loves.
It's a great prayer. Let's have another.
This is called Dominion of Men. In 10th grade, I knocked out someone twice my age and weight. Larry, a veteran with a wrecked knee, who begged my friend and me to taste the spicy joint we blazed. Larry could usually be seen on a lawn chair, nodding between the brushstrokes of numbness, heroin painted in his veins.
Mm.
We refused to share our smoke, and I made a joke that spurred Larry to an anger in which he called us niggers and began swinging his metal cane. I threw a left hand straight that popped open Larry's cheek. He dropped and bled heavily. For weeks, my buddies spread tales of the triumph to everyone, but the punch was luck, a thoughtless reaction that found the unguarded head of an addict who'd racked up enough petty wrongs to earn a defeat from a skinny teen. Larry has since gone completely to dirt, his gravestone laid flat on the grass, his name underscored by the chiseled words, soldier, father, brother, son.
Mm.
I have a son now.
Mm.
I'll soon teach him the bit of boxing I know, his fists harmless as bald dough. Eventually, those fists could win him entry into the strange dominion of men, where faces grow grim during stories of love, and where faces become bright throughout fables full of pain.
There's so much in that, so much in that about not shame, but pride. And yet a little remorse. You certainly knew what you did.
Yeah.
And how and why. How do we teach that? How do we teach our students courage to go back in memory and tell the truth about something that wasn't really so pleasant?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it starts with faith and a strange combination of sounds or a new avenue of language that they wouldn't find in other means of communication in the world.
Oh, so you think that's a protection?
I think that if you can unlock a sense of music inside you that is tied to a memory, there will ultimately be revelation, and there will ultimately be complexities that you didn't think you could get in a draft where you were just kind of free writing or writing from.
So craft is important to you.
It's very important because I think that the ear or the way that language sounds and has a different existence for each of us, I think that is more of a successful should I say government, since we're in D.C.? It's more of a successful government of a topic or a subject in literature than, say, the brain, which is usually trying to make some type of argument or keep up appearances in some way.
Can you do it? Can your students do it?
A lot of them can, yeah. I think that it's just giving people space and freedom to trust the strangeness or to trust what they've been told not really to talk about.
That, coupled with giving them the esteem enough to do that. Marcus Jackson is here with us. He's come. He's driven day and night all the way from Ohio. So let's hear a couple more.
Sure. Baby boy in the back room. While a weekday party grew in the front of a foul flat, you slept in a car seat set upon a mattress that had no sheets. You dreamed, and your young mother drank a quart of malt, and she wouldn't smile until a foam halo lay at the bottle's base. Tunes with curses in the choruses boomed. We teen boys roared and wore too much toughness. Tramping back from the toilet, I saw you and stepped close enough to hear the ricocheting breeze of your breathing. I thought of praying in that bedroom for your safety or for the knobless door to somehow slow down all the ugliness building beyond. I chose only to crouch, to kiss your head's tender top and return to my pint of rank wine, my cigarette left balancing on an upturned beer cap, to one night in a great array of nights when we hid our hurt and mistook the world for an ordeal no father could make gentler.
Mm. Will you read that last stanza? It is a killer stanza, the last one.
To the one night in a great array of nights when we hid our hurt and mistook the world for an ordeal no father could make gentler.
That hurts. That's so good it hurts. So nobody could help. You took your hurt and lashed it out into the world. But then you kissed that baby.
Yeah, that's the dilemma is we're taught, we inherit such a system of violence and a certain set of reactions to that violence. And it's only at a few pivotal moments in one's life where you can rebel by turning away from the violence and then trying to tap into a new vocabulary of tenderness or a new emotional sector.
That's why this book blew me away. I am not kidding. Because of that combination of recognition of what the world trained you to do and what instinctively you could not tolerate. Let's have another poem.
Sure.
Marcus Jackson is here, and this is going to really change people, this book, Pardon My Heart. What a good title.
This poem's titled Evasive Me. Of course there's a certificate, bleeding carbon at the creases and impressions, detailing my metrics and lineage, the night I entered the earthly air in a new hospital, built by the intricate partnership between Rust Belt governance, capitalism, and Christ. Though I lie to people I like, saying I was born in a garden so near the sea that my mother, multilingual and remarkably tall, rinsed me at the fringe of the tide the morning after labor, the horizon cloudless and birdless, while the sand whispered spells of protection, depth, and solemnity upon the pair of us. And amidst this farce, my dear listeners don expressions of distrust or ire, as likely they should, faced with evasive me, so wearied even before boyhood that, by the truth, that I forever disallowed my ears and my mouth any songs not made from the water, dirt, wind, salt, and fire of American manipulation.
Tell us about that.
This actually came, if I remember correctly, there was one day I was just so fed up with the current news feed, which was revolving around the birther debate when Obama was in office. And I coupled that frustration with a poem I've always loved called I was born in Lucerne by Phil Levine. It's in the book One for the Rose. And I think that we seek out mythic secondary origin stories. It's what makes us the species that we are. And I wanted to try and get at that with this poem.
Well, has there been a poem in this book that was so hard to write that you had to overcome something? Or was that all of them?
It was a good deal of them.
But is there one that I do not want to do this, I do not want to say this, I do not want to tell the truth?
Yeah, I think that, the title poem, because I was grappling early on in the writing process of the book, the title poem is one that I wrote, maybe the first 10 poems that I wrote for the book. And I was working very strictly in form, and almost all the poems broke out of form, because I realized that the emotional honesty and the urgency of improvisation and of having to make ends meet that exist in blues and jazz and hip hop, that's so much a part of my soul that I had to break the form of pretty much every poem and listen to their voices and let them be themselves on the page.
That's a great answer, because that's a lesson, really. You just had to sometime let them take their own shape, right?
Right. Because when I sat down to start the book, I was like, I'm gonna chase these traditional forms.
Well, you
because,
do have
because
them.
I've neglected them earlier in my career, and but I did end up finding.
But the nice thing about your form is that we don't know it's there. And I like that. It's also embedded and intricately braided that I don't feel it's intrusive. So,
thank you.
A plus. Okay. Let's have another poem.
Sure. This is called Goodale Park. A hunched man speaks Korean to the geese, feeding them old bread at the pond brim, while much of the park late April is a unified green breathing. When the clusters of ducks bob backward from submergence, their beaks look lacquered, and they shimmy their wings as if deflecting mortality. A tall can of common beer in a paper sleeve does for me what the burgeoning season does for the ducks. The yeasty froth and the slight sting imbue some peace after a year of grieving a brother who, in youth, screamed elatedly when our mother, her eyes widened and softened by codeine, first showed us how to draw frenzies of the large, long-traveled birds by tossing pieces of stale sourdough onto the edge of the park's dark water.
I love the way that last line punctuates with single monosyllabic words. What's that last line?
Onto the edge of the park's dark
On
water.
On the edge of the park's dark water. What made you do all of this you've done? What were you like? How did you start noticing things? Were you born just observing details? Were you that kind of kid? Or is it something you learned? I know graduate school doesn't do it.
I was lucky enough to be born extremely wealthy. I'm just kidding. I was born broke. I was lucky enough to be born to two parents who were actors. So we couldn't afford a babysitter. So from the age of 3 and 4 and 5, we would be sitting in the audience chairs during rehearsals.
You
of,
must write a book about
of
that.
Some of the serious 60s and 70s American dramas. So that was language for me. Was immediately a physical, orally riffed on element.
That was an exciting life, though.
It was great.
But that's got to be a whole different book.
Yeah.
You haven't talked about that yet.
Yeah.
Really, name one play you can remember seeing.
One of the more difficult ones, which I really applaud my mom for having the bravery to be in, and for having the bravery to invite my sister and me to all the rehearsals and all the performances, was a play called Extremities, which is really just a two-person, well, their production was a two-person play. I can't remember if the original script is, but it's about, I believe, a college student or a young professional female who gets stalked and a rapist breaks into her house, she overcomes him physically and locks him in the fireplace. And the whole play is their conversation, and they come to understand each other's perspectives a little more.
She let you, she really let you immerse yourself early on. Yeah. Give us another poem.
Sure. This is called I Don't Do This Much, But. I don't do this much, but I'm a sucker for the wondrously torn apart type. And the stare you've been giving me is quite the installment of radiant dismantlement. I love this place. It's overpoured bottom shelf specials, it's stained ceiling tiles, and the way the daytime street and people through the front window accent my expedient bewilderment. For a second or so, I pondered not talking to you, leaving the wavelengths of our respective singularities to hum at different ends of the bar, and then my dead mother's voice called out my cursed foolhood, my faithlessness, and distrusting the glaring likeliness that you overhear in an attire and posture that must have accompanied you through miles of disquiet, thrill, retreat, and dreaming, swiftly drinking what I'm guessing is your third gin gimlet, might become inclined to hear a few more peculiar, fervent notes about the outlandish soul my body hardly holds.
It's a good thing your body doesn't hold your soul, or we wouldn't have any of this. What's the first thing you say to your students on the first class of the first day of the first year? What's the first thing you say?
I hope everybody's in the right room. In all seriousness, my main thing is just trying to create a safe space, because America does not feel safe for so many of us. And once we know that in a room of writers, everything we can imagine, everything we try is protected, at least within those walls, I think that's when the creation really can become possible.
I love that answer.
This is called The Former Us. Remember when our bodies were novel, when down to the particle were want and gloss? Tonight, it takes a few drinks apiece and slight lies for the former us to surface, for our mouths to go buoyant, our eyes to wipe lambent. For a song or two, we're our pre-procreation, our pre-career, our pre-refinanced selves, walking tipsy down an empty street. Talking too loud, groping each other, nearing your dark, one-windowed apartment. Both of us wrongly sure we won't do anything irreparable to each other.
Is that a memory?
That poem, I think, was written pretty early on in the composition process for the book. And it was a projection. I was a newlywed at the time, and we were renting, and I think we were between jobs. And I projected forward toward what it might feel like in 5 years or 10 years for a partnership.
Yeah, to try to rev it up.
Yeah.
Yes.
And from, you know, what I've seen from friends and loved ones.
What do you think is the American dream now?
Now, I mean, to go back to the word safety, mine is safety. I've always been a very scared person because my mom was always honest with me, and she said, you know, you could walk out in the street and the wrong person could be there, and it could be devastating. And I feel...
I think that's in the book.
Yeah,
I grew up in the
crack epidemic, and things felt very dangerous then, but they're dangerous in a much different way now. So my dream has always been for everybody to feel as safe as possible.
Well, you can be sure that your book does that, so you accomplished it. And now have a final poem.
Sure. Pardon my heart. Pardon my heart if it ruins your party. It's a large American heart and has had a good deal to drink. It's a pretty bad dancer, too much feeling, too little technique. It may sing some godless hymns about ousting armies of loneliness, about marching victorious to wives and towns beneath a heart-colored dusk. Pardon my heart if it closes its eyes for hours, whispering rapture over and over. Pardon my heart if it laughs too loudly, or if it tells many of its stories too ardently. Pardon my heart if it rests an arm across you or your friend's shoulders. Touch allows my heart to trust that it's not imagining your company's loveliness. Pardon my heart if you have to kick it out. After you've muzzled the music and brightened the lights to tidy, my heart will ignore and keep doing its little two-step, a glow in the middle of the room, never happier to have nowhere else to go.
That is the voice of Marcus Jackson, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Michael Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with additional support from the SciNipid Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.